All right. So right now I'm looking at a chart. It's from Twitter. So, you know, keep it, take it for what it's worth.
Yeah. All right.
And it was big thing in the, like the bookish writer Twitter a week ago, which, you know, in Twitter time is like a decade ago, but we're recording now. So it is a sci-fi fantasy writer. It's called a canceledness chart. And it's a quadrant. At the top is good writers. The bottom is bad writers. And from left to right is least canceled, most canceled. Mm. We're going to ignore the canceled parts because who cares? But on the good, bad writer spectrum,
I kind of want to hear what some of the least canceled, like how, like what did they do?
Oh, I'll tell you that. Excellent. But I wanted to point out down at the bottom, bad writer, least canceled, is Neil Gaiman. Bad writer on the quadrant of canceled but not too bad is George R. R. Martin. Asimov is in the bad writer quadrant, and so is Ray Bradbury.
Huh.
And I kind of resent that chart.
That was just made to upset you.
Exactly. I mean, that's what people do.
What if Google knew you like those writers and the quadrant just changed? Technology was so intense that it knew how to create a story just to piss you off. And if you showed someone else today, actually the quadrant on my side says Ursula K. Le Guin's in the bad writer category.
Oh, yeah.
What if it was like that?
They can flip it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just how Twitter works. Some random person creates something, knowing that people talk about it. Ursula Le Guin is in the good writer, least canceled. She's like, and Octavia Butler are up there.
Just good people.
Yeah, which, you know, I have no quibble with, but it's also who cares? And you know what? Because I'm looking at Gaiman, Martin, and Asimov, and Bradbury. Oh, and J.K. Rowling's there too. I suspect their sins are their popular.
Hmm.
You know what I mean?
I briefly mentioned this, and we probably shouldn't get into it. Asimov does have like a...
Sure, yeah. Well, and that's why I didn't want to talk
about it. He's the only one that I know of that has a little bit of a... probably deserves to be in the... whatever. The quadrant thing, you're giving me flashbacks to... geometry class. No, not calculus. I don't know.
It's four. There's four pieces. It's pretty. It's like my kids' puzzles.
If you would have said four square thing, I would have gotten it.
Four square. Yeah.
Four square. Gotcha. Perfect. Four square. Quadrants.
Yeah. So, and I didn't want to get in, you know, what the artist and their work and the canceled part, I kind of don't care about. Yeah. But just the good and bad writer stuff. It's like, I think there's a certain type of person who sees hating on things that are popular or sell well as a shortcut to being or seeming sophisticated. You know what I mean? Everybody likes this. Well, I don't like it.
Yeah.
And you just kind of like,
here's the issue. Sometimes it's true. Would you consider Dan Brown a good writer?
I think he wrote an entertaining book. I'll defend Da Vinci Code. It's not literature.
Okay.
But it's a fun little...
What I think happens is people who like the literature, quote unquote, like the, you know, the English literature, they look at the Dan Browns. Yeah, some of those names on the list I don't get. They look at the Dan Browns and say, well, that's not what I like, so that's therefore bad, which is a dangerous way of going about your reading.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, especially a lot of modern, what gets marketed as lit fic, it becomes being serious for the sake of being serious. And you get into your head, oh, serious literature can't have plots. It's got to be autofiction. And there's no real reason for it. And I think you may be just imitating sort of some weird Girardian fashion, what other people are doing. And you kind of get lost in this thing. And if anything's popular or in the least bit entertaining or hints, you get a whiff of anything like genre fiction, it becomes not serious and looked down upon by the bien pensant.
I like to sometimes draw the writing stuff back to like music. It's kind of like when the indie band starts getting played on the radio. and they start selling their tickets for $100, stuff like that, stadium shows, bigger shows. They're no longer good anymore. They're just, they've appealed to too many people, right?
Sure. Or, but that the type of person, hipster person who really likes music, it's not that their music may not be any better or worse. It's just they reflect poorly on the hipster musician's conception of themselves as somebody who only likes indie stuff. And now that this band is popular and can tour and can make money, they're no longer the type of band that the hipster music critic wants to see himself as enjoying. So he has to move on and he has to devour what he once loved. How's that?
I like it. But I'm going to push back on you. I agree with you. But I think also two things can also be, both sides can be wrong at the same time. Like the people, the hipster, oh, it's popular, it's not good. That's wrong. But also sometimes when a writer's like achieved huge success and fame, further works, future works might suffer from that.
Yes. And that's
and that can also be, so both things I think can happen.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
But it's kind of on an individual basis, right? Yeah.
And with this, in this case, George Martin, Neil Gaiman, and Ray Bradbury are all good writers and were solid. Or,
yeah, you
know, two of them are still gone.
Can you, do you still have the quadrant up?
Yeah.
Can you tell me good writer, also canceled? What are we at here?
Okay, so Lewis Carroll and Philip K. Dick are really high on the good writer, but really canceled.
I didn't know that.
Philip K. Dick, did, I mean, he had like... He had six wives, but I don't think he did anything like...
Shouldn't it like really be canceled? Shouldn't that be known by everybody in society?
Sure. Well, yeah. And then canceled, like, are we talking murder? Or are we talking, you know, they just... Philip K. Dick
are
had...
Are we talking jail or are we talking...
Yeah, Philip K. Dick had a turbulent personal life, but he wasn't...
I don't want to weigh anything
you know what I
don't
mean?
Know like, anything about, but I'm just saying, if it's really canceled, like...
So just to give a... Tolkien, for whatever reason, is on the canceled side, but he's in the good writer.
Okay.
I don't know, it's silly. Who's... Yeah, Ursula Le Guin and Octavia Butler are good writer, least canceled. Neil Gaiman's really far down on the bad writer. That's really what set me off here. I'm like, hey.
I was doing a little research for tonight's episode.
Yeah.
About Neil Gaiman and his book Neverwhere. And the thing I saw that he got in trouble with recently during COVID times, he and his partner at the time were in New Zealand and he flew, I'm not exactly sure where he flew. I believe he flew to England. I could be completely wrong. And he broke COVID rules and he apologized for that. So that's, I was wondering if that's what got him canceled. Recently.
No, he's on the least canceled, just the bad writer part.
That's weird.
It's stupid. It's basically some person on Twitter's opinion. But I was hoping to use it as a segue into do popular amongst literary hipster types, I think being popular or selling well kind of counts as a strike against you.
I would say it's a difficult question because writer, and we'll get into this when we talk about the book. I would say Neil Gaiman is a better storyteller than writer, if that makes sense.
I think he's good at both. But and some of that might be an opinion or matter of taste. I think he's a good writer too.
I don't have any issue with him as a writer. Like I'm a bad writer, I would consider him a better idea story, which I think lends itself to how he divides his time and work through different mediums. Like the Sandman show that just came out, I think on Netflix, my wife's watching that. And he's done, you know, comic books, he's graphic, you know, a host of other things than just the novel, which leads me to believe that I think I think his talents are best at creating larger stories, maybe. Which
sure. Well, he's a very good storyteller. And I don't know how useful, I mean, I see what you mean. And there is in the minds of a lot of people, the distinction between writing and storytelling, but I don't know that there needs to be. To me, that seems like kind of an arbitrary distinction. You know what I mean? A big part of writing is storytelling, and being able to tell a compelling story is, I think, an overrated or no, underrated skill.
Oh, I agree.
Let me get back, because I was almost going to go into have a little defense of Dan Brown. Might have said it before a couple years ago on this thing, but Dan Brown got that book sold so well that everybody was reading it, and so you felt compelled to read it, even if you don't like little airport thrillers, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. You know, so serious, college-educated, liberal or literary types started reading it, and they're like, and they treated it like somebody just shoved Faulkner or something into their hands, and they're like, "This is terrible." And they picked apart this fun thriller genre book, like it was pretending. Or had aspirations to be, this guy's the new Faulkner or whoever. And it wasn't. It was a, if you were going on a long plane flight, you're flying over to Europe for 8 hours, and you realize that the battery's dead on your phone and your iPad, crap, and I don't have a book. You, like, it's too, you know, you're just, I'm on this flight for 8 hours, I'm gonna be bored. But the person in the flight, the seat in front of you, left a copy of the Da Vinci Code, and you had that to read, you would be so grateful for it. It's a fun, fast-paced story. And if you, it wasn't popular, somebody just left this random book and that's what you had, you would read it, you'd been enthralled, it would have made the plane trip go by fast. It was a fun book. And that's it. And that's what it was. And that's what Dan Brown writes. And then it just got so popular, people started like picking it apart because it was popular, and they kind of missed it. Yeah, it's not gonna change your life, but it's fun. You know what I mean? So everything also, I think, has its place. But I've come back around.
So fired up.
To defend, you know what? No, Dan Brown is good for what he writes. I'm not, you'll hear no piling on of Dan Brown from this half of the podcast.
And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and Dan Brown defenders. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Can't really say anything about Dan Brown because I haven't read the book, so but I wanted to, I feel like we were just heading off into like the rest of the podcast, so I kind of want to end it, wrap up the intro there. But if you couldn't gather from that, we're talking about Neil Gaiman, specifically Neverwhere tonight. This was kind of a side project for me, I guess, on the podcast, where I was going to try another Neil Gaiman book. Before we started this podcast, I think I knew you when I had read American Gods, the first Neil Gaiman book I tried, and I did not like it. Yeah. I thought it was overly long. It partly probably my fault. The subject matter just didn't interest me, and I didn't give it my full attention. But I had to rate it how I did. I think I gave like 2 stars or something like that. But I've always wanted to go back to him. You like Neil Gaiman. I've met a lot of people in my life that have liked Neil Gaiman. So I decided I'm going to give him another shot, right?
Yeah.
And I thought Neverwhere would probably be the one that would be most up my alley, so to speak.
It's a good entry point for people who are.
And I'm happy to report, so that we can continue to do this podcast and be friends, that I really enjoyed the book. And all the issues I had with American Gods, I really did not have with Neverwhere.
And I think you're just not into mythology in general. And then you didn't know about the Norse stuff. So
yes, but I thought the book was very, very long. And it didn't, I think I struggle when a book is very long and just doesn't, I'm not clicking with what the author obviously cares about. And sure. If that happens, there's really nothing you can do to sort of save the experience. Like, you can kind of ruin a reading experience by just like putting a book down for a long stretch of time, right?
Yeah.
I've kind of done that with Black Leopard, Red Wolf. I like that book a lot more than American Gods, but I've done Marlon James, I feel like, a disservice by like reading 100 pages and then setting it aside for a week and a half.
Yeah, maybe you have to immerse yourself in the...
Yeah, I think there is... It's Yeah, there maybe the author is requiring you to sort of immerse yourself or not take these huge breaks. Like, I'm not confused, but I'm not anyway. Neverwhere, I thought was, and it's interesting that this was, he decided to write this book, his first novel, after like the kind of creating a TV series at the same time. So he would, you know, stuff got taken out of the show. And I read, for those listening, I don't know if what exactly, this is the authoritative text or the author's
preferred edition.
Edition. So I don't know how different this is than the copy that came out in 1996. I think there's some issues with like the prologue and stuff like that. But so I can't speak to how this differs from the original text. But I thought from a story standpoint, from a character standpoint, I think there's some really great characters in this. Good, interesting topics are kind of delved into, sort of the nature of the forgotten people in society.
Homelessness a little bit.
Yeah, homelessness, yeah. And sort of kind of the, what would you call him? Richard Mayhew, not the protagonist, but the...
He's the protagonist, yeah.
Well, see, I kind of thought the, I always forget her name, Door,
yeah.
I kind of thought she, in a way, was...
I guess they both are. If you'd go with the protagonist as the character who wants... The main character who wants something.
But I thought Richard Mayhew was a...
Richard wanted to get back to normal.
I think he's a bit of an everyman type of character, where, you know...
Oh, yeah, he's 100% the everyman.
The kind of... The unfulfilling life, and he sees this... other world and kind of and learns about himself and what he values, I guess, in life. But it's like I said, so character-wise, story-wise, great villains in this book.
Oh yeah.
Interesting concept of like a alternate London where this world takes place. I think this book probably influenced a lot of fantasy. I think some of them.
Oh yeah. Well,
V. Schwab, I feel like, and I think she does count Gaiman as an influence, but her magic series is very similar to this.
Oh, I thought of Addie LaRue.
I did think of Addie LaRue.
When they, you know, the people from London below can't really be seen by the London above.
Yeah. When he goes up and I thought of
Addie. You want to do a quick plot?
Go ahead.
What starts off, this normal guy from Scotland moves to London for a job in just what, accounts or finance or some, you know, nice corporate office job that allows him to live in a nice apartment. He's got a fiance who's a very go-getter.
He's a real pistol, if I say so.
The first 50 pages are funny. It's like
it's a funny book. Yeah.
It could almost be a comedy of manners. Like he can write funny. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever, he wrote a book with Terry Pratchett called Good Omens, which is hilarious. That so he can do the understated British funny. Mm-hmm. And the first, I don't know what, 50 pages are almost kind of like that. And so you're just, this guy is kind of just goes along to get along. And then something happens. He's on his way to, a big dinner with his fiance's boss, who's almost like a Rupert Murdoch type, just a big wig. And it's very important to his fiance that he goes. And then there's this like poor, we could call her homeless girl, but the other protagonist in the story. From London below, there's a whole other parallel London, a whole other...
I'd help you out, but I have a cramp in my leg.
No. So this homeless girl kind of pops out of nowhere and she's bleeding and obviously been injured. And Richard decides to help her.
Save her.
Help her rather than go to dinner with his fiance. And so right there, he chooses to do the right thing over. And his fiance is horrified. She's like, just call an ambulance. Somebody will get her. Kind of, you know, indicative of how people treat homeless people. Right. And so we kind of know who this person is from. It's kind of the stories woven together. It's almost like an adult Narnia book where Richard, our protagonist, kind of by helping the girl whose name is Dor. Mm-hmm. By helping her, he kind of gets sucked into this world. And in the world of Neverwhere, there's a place called London Below, where all the outcasts and misfits, it's almost like an allegory for being homeless, but it's not a one-to-one allegorical tale, I don't think. But it's just like this weird world of eccentric people, forgotten people, and it's kind of the place they go. It's where Dor's from. And from there, it's like a Peter Pan, Narnia type thing for adults. This guy getting sucked into this other world, and he wants to go home, but in order to go home, he has to go through certain ordeals and like find the key and, you know, whatever, go on a little adventure.
He does a good job of creating Richard's story, his arc, and then he drops it very seamlessly into the story arc of Dor and what she needs to do. So he kind of does it. I really enjoy this when an author takes, like, okay, here's my reader who's, you know, like a typical person in normal life, and how do I introduce this new world? Well, I'm going to introduce it through the eyes of, like, the everyman reader kind of thing.
Yeah,
that makes sense. So, like, you're encountering this world that's interesting and diverse, and there's a kind of, you're learning about the elements of who's good, who's bad, through the eyes of Richard, who plays these sort of like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he becomes more comfortable with the world, right? And it's part adventure, it's part kind of commentary. It's Dor's dealing with her past and kind of the tragedy of her past. And I don't know, I think it all those elements work out really well. I think I think that's the biggest, for me personally, and this is my opinion, that's the biggest appeal and why this book has been so successful, so popular, so many people love it, is the sort of, sometimes you just, if you do, I'm not saying it's basic, but if you do the simple thing and remember, like, what are the elements to a story, and not just sort of like, that's been done before. Sometimes doing the thing that's been done before is really smart, and it you know.
Well, yeah, there's only so many ways to say something or so many stories.
He remembers, like, oh, it's about good characters, it's about good villains, it's about,
it's a good story, it's a well-told
story, it's all these things, while also having an interesting setting.
Exactly. You don't want to fetishize originality just for the sake of being original. Then you get away. I think that's happened a lot in a lot of the weird experimental fiction. They've gotten away from story because they think, oh, it means it's been done before and I'm not being original. And with a lot of the experimental stuff, you get just weird, incoherent, babbly things. Where if you know how to tell a story, sure, there are quote unquote tropes. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think they're tropes. I think in a well-told story, there are certain beats you have to hit. Yeah. And you can, if you do them well, people don't notice. And so the kind of pejorative or cynical way to think of them are tropes. But they're actually, no, you got to hit this beat. You have to have a protagonist who wants something. And in this type of story, it's kind of, you know, protagonist is taken to an other world. And so you have to explain the world. There needs to be villains and obstacles and, you know, a magical old man, help somebody who helps you find the way. And all this, the villain is somebody you thought was a good guy. All this stuff, it needs to happen to make the story fulfilling. And it's how well you pull that off with how much, use a French word, Peter, panache. You can pull that stuff off with, I think. It counts as storytelling and stuff like that, counts as writing. I don't think it needs to be.
No, so here's what for me, Gaiman in this book, like, I never felt like he was trying to force stuff. He was never, you ever feel like an author's like fingerprints or like trying to force the story into a, I don't know, trying to make a point, he's trying to be political, he's trying to be.
Yeah, it's been known to happen.
Yes. I thought he was just like, I have this great story And his writing was energetic. It was fun. There's drama to it. There's like excitement. I think there's a lot. I think it's just, he created something that, and well thought out. I don't know. I can't really pick too many, you know, problems with the book. The complete opposite reading experience to American Gods. Like, I wanted to read this book. I read it fairly fast. I wasn't expecting to read it that fast because we have a million other books we're reading right now. But I guess, you know, a compliment could be like, you kind of don't notice how many pages you're going by.
It's because he's a good writer. And that quadrant from the random Twitter user was silly.
So, yeah, I mean, it's I wouldn't say it's a pleasant surprise. I was kind of expecting to like it in a weird way. Is that weird to say since I really didn't like his other book I read? And I don't think it was so much for the writing. It was more for the story. And like I said, it could be my fault. I don't really want to revisit that book, but
this is all subject. No. I was thinking of this because in my head, when I was preparing this, I was going to bring up how I want to revisit American Gods. Mm-hmm. And I was in my head, I was already, you know, you kind of picture the way this is going.
Yeah.
Like this morning, I was like, and Peter, calm down. I'm not going to make you read it. And I worried you'd kind of like be like my son when he doesn't want to eat something. Yeah, he's like, no, shaking his head, and he'll just throw it on the floor. It's like, no, I'm just going to revisit it. You don't have to.
I would consider revisiting it. Well, let me preface this. If I could read 50 pages of it, maybe 60, like, let me see what I'm missing.
Well, and so
I think I've become a more adventurous reader in the last. I want to say I read that book probably 14 years ago, if I was to guess.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So I feel like I've become a more adventurous reader. I'm up for challenges. I'm reading out of my comfort zone more. So maybe that with the mythology, I will say this, that sort of like mythology stuff is not up my alley.
So maybe you don't worry about that right now. What you need to do, you should read, he's got a good, Stardust is a good, fun book.
Okay.
There's a book, it's kind of similar to this, like an adult, like a fantasy book.
Anasazi.
Like a kid's fantasy book, but it's like adults. It's adult themed.
Uh-huh.
That makes sense. It's called The Ocean at the End of the Lane.
I was going to say, I think my friend recommended that one to me.
Very good. It's good. And it's kind of like this. Okay. It's reminiscent of one of those Peter Pan, Narnia kid type books where magical things start happening, but the themes aren't kids' themes. It's like written for adults about things adults would understand, but the story is structured like a kid's fantasy novel.
Gotcha.
So The Ocean at the End of the Lane is where we should go next for Game It, or even just a short story. He does a really good, there are two really good Sherlock Holmes stories he's done for anthologies. One's like a Sherlock Holmes, H.P. Lovecraft mashup. And then there's another.
In my head, for some reason, I feel like he should have written more books. And he's fine with how many books he's written. But in my mind, I'm like, gosh, I thought he wrote like a dozen books. Like a dozen novels, let's say. Because he's done. But if I'm looking at his, like the first page, like what he's done. So he's Good Omens. He wrote Terry Pratchett. That was in 1990, I believe. Neverwhere comes out in 96. So we have Stardust, American Gods, which was like, was American Gods a bigger hit than Neverwhere? It was.
Oh, I don't know to compare the two, but American Gods was where I first read him.
And okay.
I loved it. So that put him on my radar. And that took a long time to write too. I mean, that's a huge.
And he's had I would think after American Gods, each of his books, after that become like an event type of book, so to speak, maybe like Coraline, which they I think I saw a movie for that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to pronounce this right. How do you pronounce that? Boys in Nazi Boys?
Oh, Nazi Boys. Yeah, yeah.
Graveyard Book, and then The Ocean at the End of the Lane.
So that's three short story collections.
Okay. Right?
And his short stories are good.
Smoke and Mirrors and Fragile Things are the two I've heard.
There's one called Trigger Warning, which came out later.
Gotcha.
The short story collections are solid. They're a lot of, I don't like a lot of literary short stories because they're.
I agree, me too.
But these are things happen, they're fun, they're interesting. His short story collections are solid. So I would actually throw in those. And that's actually quite a bit. And you left out what put him on the map just in general was the Sandman comics.
Yes, which they
that was, and those
into a TV show.
It's actually pretty good. And now he's like, he was the showrunner for the Good Omens TV series they did. And now he's kind of doing.
He has a lot of comic book work. I mean, just reading about him, like he seems constantly busy. But he seems in a way, when you hear about like Brandon Sanderson's, like he's just writing like multiple mm-hmm. different series all at once. Neil Gaiman's not like doing the series thing, but he seems like, okay, I'm doing the TV show. I'm doing a comic book. I'm writing a novel. Maybe I'm doing a play. So it seems like that's how he's, and he's also a bit of a, he's like an, kind of like an author celebrity. There's not many authors.
Yeah.
There's not many authors where it's like, oh, there's Neil Gaiman, or, you know, like that's, if Neil Gaiman does something, there's going to be like an article about it.
Yeah. He's a good interview too. I listened to his podcast, the Marc Maron podcast he just did.
Mm.
It's fun doing this podcast. I can do stuff like that, and I call it research. You know? I was like, what you doing? It's like, research. I was watching YouTube, but I wanted to get into kind of like why I like him.
Yeah.
Kind of a throwback. It's similar-ish reasons for why I like Gore Vidal so much, and why... I like Hitchens less now, but even I enjoyed Hitchens a lot. And even David Foster Wallace and some of those, there's the author as personality where you enjoy their work. They're really good, but they also give a good interview. You're interested in what they have to say. And like Vidal and Hitchens, Gaiman is very open about his writing process, like what he reads. He was just a book dork growing up, and he writes very well in his nonfiction essays about what he was influenced by, why he loves these certain books. And it led me to read other things that I now love. You know, like Vidal yeah. led to Don Powell, Hitchens led to Flashman and Woodhouse. Neil Gaiman led me to Michael Moorcock. And there's a very good book called Votan. Or Wotan, whatever, by John James. And that's an incredible book. And I wouldn't have heard of all that if I hadn't read, you know, Neil Gaiman. So that's, it's kind of,
you bring up a very interesting idea and topic, I think.
What's that?
Basically, you're saying that Gaiman is a good showman, like a good interview, a good sound by a good interesting mm-hmm. thought. So therefore that like increases the worth of his books, or like you're enjoying.
No, that wouldn't be my therefore. That's one of the reasons I okay. like, but I don't think his books are what they are. And there are plenty of good authors who are introverts. I'm just saying I appreciate Gaiman as a personality, and I tend to like authors as personalities, but.
Is he like a little bit of like a cultural spoke, like from Gaiman you get these different authors.
And that's why I like
influences other people.
Yeah. Too. But it doesn't impact their work. You know what I mean? Like I like Gore Vidal's work separate from, I also enjoy his interviews and watching old YouTube clips. I don't like his work because of the personality. If that makes sense. It's just, he happens to also give a good interview.
Has the reverse happened where you're like, I don't like the personality. There's an author I'm not going to say, but I know we've talked about this off air, whose personality like currently has made you not like, or maybe not like, but maybe.
There are a couple who, yeah, especially.
Aggravate you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But see.
I guess I won't say, yeah, no, that can happen too. They're just so loud about certain things. And it's not even that I disagree with them. It's like, you're acting like a 13-year-old on Twitter. Well, it really makes me not want to read your book.
It's almost, it's like the author trying to score easy points like constantly. I don't like that. I find that grating, and I agree on that. But in the other sense, like, since we are living at the same time as said author, let's say, and they're living real time with us and they're interacting with sort of culture, and it's maybe it annoys us. What if this was like 100 years ago and all we had were the books, and we're not like reading the newspaper where author X is like commenting on, you know, the current, would that change your mind? Like, let's say an author is annoying during his time. Should that influence your enjoyment of his work? I would say no, but it's hard to separate the two. Does that make sense?
Sure, it is hard. Well, okay. So first off, it is hard to separate the two. Mm-hmm. Like the person we're talking about, he writes good books that I really enjoy.
They're really good.
But I really don't have an interest in reading the next one because he's such a little snot online. And it's just, I know it's not fair. I shouldn't feel that way, yeah. But I do. So in theory, no, I'd like to think I'm above that, but frankly, you're not. And in the past, you'd have less visual medium and stuff would come at you faster and you'd get less gossip, but there were still authors as personalities back then. I mean, Mark Twain basically did a stand-up tour. Dickens made a lot of money doing speak. You know, there were authors as personalities, but I guess maybe they could be more managed.
But
you wouldn't have access to all the gossip, and Twitter allows for people you would otherwise think are smart and sophisticated to make absolute fools of themselves.
If you're going back to, like, let's say Twain, you're probably going to read the novels first before you read the like newspaper articles.
And that's why you want to go see him, is because you read his novels.
Yeah. And so I think it's just an interesting thing to think about in this age of like, because I think it's tricky because an author can sort of promote their work online if they're constantly being engaged.
Well,
I was looking up, there's these articles where it's like the best author Twitter follower. I'm like, why? That has no appeal to me, but it has appeal to a lot of people, right? They want to be in a community where there's people with like-minded, and it's yada, 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 whatever. I'm more interested in like what the books are, but I get why people get addicted and enthralled. Because I was thinking about this. Twitter. This is like a weird subject and I don't really want to pull on it too much. It's only a platform for very popular people, right? Because they can tweet inane, random things, right?
Yeah.
And since they have people who listen to that, will interact with that. But a person with no followers says the exact same thing and they're looked at and they get no traction, let's say.
Yeah.
They're looked at as like a sad person talking into the void. Like, what is the purpose of this? So it's really only a platform for people who I feel like it breeds a little bit of a narcissism in people, right?
Well, I think social media in general encourages that sort of narcissism.
So the author,
we're on Twitter. We have there will be books.
Yeah.
Be just one be Twitter and Instagram. We're on all these platforms.
Is this now? If you get to a level where you have thousands and millions of people following you, it's got to be a weird, it's a disconnect. You're not in.
Sure. And if you're on there all the time, like you see some people just use as promotion. Like Neil Gaiman uses his Twitter. He kind of promotes stuff.
Yeah.
He's pretty generous with like fans and people. He'll retweet them. But like, that's the way to kind of do it. He's not out there, you know.
I've only read one of his books, but I kind of enjoy Brandon Sanderson's, like, he gives updates on how he's writing. I think that's a clever way of doing it. Like, which book, which series is he working on, which projects he's working on. I might not be the biggest fan. I'm not reading all these books, but I think that's an interesting way of going about it.
That's what you're doing. It's a weird thing. Like, you kind of have to be on it or on something like that to promote your stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's also a trap. In a silly place.
I had a question for you. Do you prefer, either way, doesn't matter, but do you prefer your author, let's just say like in a perfect world, your favorite author to be sort of online and have a presence, or do you prefer them to be just sort of, you don't really know too much about them?
Depends on what they do.
Okay.
Like, let's see. Oh, when we did American Rust, yeah. I was looking up Philip Meyer to see if he was on Twitter. And he wasn't. And I was like, pleased. I was like, ah, oh, good for you, man. I knew it. And doesn't there's something about him and American Rust and The Sun and his other books. I'm like, yeah, yeah, man. Stay off Twitter. Good for you.
Could you say that he's not really writing books for like entertainment? That like his books are like
no, but America The Sun is
The Sun was book. Yeah, The Sun.
And so was I enjoyed American Rust. You know? And but he's considered serious literature because he deals with, you know, some weighty themes. I don't know, but I enjoyed his books and he doesn't have a big personality. Oh, you know who else I was kind of relieved wasn't on Twitter?
Who's that?
Dennis Lehane.
Yeah?
The man's just chilling.
The wife and I just watched the Dennis Lehane created show, Blackbird.
That was
very good.
Like it?
Yeah. If you have Apple TV, I highly recommend it. Don't.
I don't have Apple TV.
Don't Google, it's a kind of a murder, true story, true crime type thing. Don't Google the person's name. Side note.
Oh, because you'll find out what happened.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's you kind of know what's going to happen from the very beginning, but yeah, anyway.
Back earlier, you were talking about in the old times, there were no scandals or gossip. I thought of the Lord Byron. The exception. He was scandalous at the time and kind of played up his reputation as an author poet.
I wouldn't say no scandal, but when we go back and read him, is it the first thing we think about is the scandal or the I think we just go back and read the
true. It comes up in the introductions.
Yeah.
But I know what you but it is right there.
But you don't have a visceral reaction.
He would drink blood out of a skull and all this stuff. You know, he played into that. So like, it did happen.
Okay, here's a weird example. People talk about like Ty Cobb, what a horrible human being. I wasn't around with Ty Cobb, but I'm like, man, yeah, he's been a real rascal, that guy. He was a bad guy. But I have no like emotional, I was never around for Ty Cobb, the baseball player, but sounds like a terrible guy. But he's a great baseball player. So if there's no, I think there is something to be said, but if you live through the person's antics or whatever, there's something to that in a generation or two or three or four that passes, people just won't have the same, you know, they won't think about that person the same.
Yeah, and I guess that's when with Byron, I'm not scandalized by what he like whatever the rumors about him were. I'm not fanning myself because he drank blood out of a skull or whatever. It's you can appreciate the work for what it is more because so much time has passed.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
It's a fun discussion, I think.
And Gaiman is one of the few, I think, authors whose work holds up, who's also a personality. Because I'm thinking back in the day, like Vidal and Mailer and all these people would go on the Tonight Show. Promote their work. There were more authors as personality. Hemingway was an international celebrity. You know what I mean? Like these were, and
well,
anymore, I don't really, I'm trying to think of people like that. And it's like Gaiman and
well, you're talking about Gaiman. Like you're talking about these big, like literary figure, drunk male white guys who were just, you know.
Sure. And they had the opportunity. But I mean,
I think the celebrity author personality has grown to include more genre fiction. I think genre writers are more famous than your, for example, Philip Meyer. I mean,
George Martin and the sci-fi people, I guess, are a hit at Comic-Con.
Crime writers, you know,
I think are bigger.
I would say only a few, like, since, you know, Stephen King's a genre writer.
Stephen King is famous, yeah.
Like, he's one of the, he's kind of a,
maybe I just live in a bubble.
I would say genre writers, and more specifically, like fantasy sci-fi writers will be.
I guess they're famous.
More famous. Partly because I think some of their work has been translated into movie and TV for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that lends itself to celebrity status.
Yeah.
In a way.
Well, true. I mean, you're known. I think a lot of people who read Stephen King actually read him. They don't just watch the movies.
And no,
I ran into a lot of people who will tell you flat out, like, I don't read a lot, but I do love Stephen King's books.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, he's a big, yeah, he's a
slut. I've never even read one page of Stephen King.
Read a couple.
I don't really say that proudly, but I just say that as a matter of fact.
Yeah, just
but
the gap. Yeah.
The gap.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. It went from like these big Mailer, Hemingway, who else would be there? Fitzgerald. And then it transitioned. I think I'd be curious to see when it sort of changes, but I would say, because I feel like Neil Gaiman's a very specific time. Like if you think about Neil Gaiman, isn't it like, I don't know why I think like late 90s England and then it continues on or whatever. It's but kinda, I feel like,
yeah. You know,
some of these authors have come from a certain time and place, but they continue to hold relevance, I guess. But
well, they're still around producing stuff.
It's true.
Producing
Neverwhere. I mean, have you seen the TV show?
No, and it's not as, it's like a BBC mid-90s. Yeah. It's not as
very modern.
And the story I heard is that Gaiman was going to try to create the TV show and write the script. And then he kind of became conscious of the fact that they weren't going to be able to translate what was in his head. The production value was going to look like a mid-90s BBC show. That just wasn't, the quality wasn't there. And he kind of wanted to rescue the work. So he turned around and just wrote the book. So the TV show wouldn't ruin the idea. It's kind of what I read. I don't know how true that is.
I have to say, there's a cover from like the 90s when this book came out. I don't know if it's UK edition. I don't know what tie-in. Maybe it's the TV show edition. Like this is the cover of the show. I don't want to, you know, be mean to anybody, but the cover art is absolutely terrible. Like, it's really bad. It doesn't. They did a really great Neil Gaiman for, I don't know if it's just US cover art, maybe the UK editions are they have these really, they're kind of artsy in a way. There's like these water colorings. Very minimalistic type stuff, but they're kind of nice to look at, I guess. But some, man, the 90s ones were, there's one in particular I found that was like, how did this get approved? It's very like, it's almost like a weird like video game cover or something. And you're like, what is this? And I don't know what they're going for, but
the 90s was wild.
It kind of toned down the Neil Gaiman like cover art. Yeah. I think it got better, but so the one I saw from, I don't know what publisher it was, but I was like, oh, that's not very good at all. So if you're into that kind of thing, if I had that cover, I'd be like, I don't really know if I want to read this book, Neverwhere. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before. Neverwhere is the first book I was trained on how to search at Barnes & Noble.
How to use a search engine.
Shout out Thane. I appreciate that. And I never heard of this book. And I spelled never in two words. And he said, no, it's one word.
You spelled it wrong.
Spelled it wrong.
And Thane thought you were an idiot for the rest of the
times.
Your life.
Yeah.
You know what's fun is the one guy. The manager guy who somebody came up to him and asked him for Siddhartha and he typed out Sid.
Arthur.
Arthur.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes though at the kiosk, you gotta like, you haven't heard the book and they're talking fast and you type in something.
Are you looking for? Yeah.
You're like, God, I gotta just guess on this one. And you're, it's a little trick of the retail book world. You're like, oh, I'm typing. And if they looked at the screen, they'd be like, are you an idiot? And you're like, ah. I caught the second part of what you were saying. And the first part I did not hear. And then you got to be like, what was that? Was that spelled? With that?
There was a guy who was asking for a book on David Bowie.
Yeah.
And I kind of, for whatever reason, I blanked on the famous David Bowie.
Yeah.
And I typed it in and a book on the Alamo came up. Sam Bowie, the guy who created the Bowie knife.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, I was like, oh, I got a couple. Let me show you. And I took him to the U.S. history and put a book on the Alamo in his hands. And he was just kind of giggling to himself. And he's like, oh, thanks, man. And I was like, oh, okay. And then it hit me later. I was like, oh, I know why he was laughing. He wanted the David Bowie. So.
You never told me that story. That's good.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on Neil Gaiman, celebrity authors, any of the stuff we talked about tonight? It's been kind of a fun discussion.
I like the topic, the celebrity author thing. I'm watching some Marlon James videos.
Okay.
For the Leopard Wolf book. He was on, I saw him on Seth Meyers.
Really?
Yeah. So he's like that. I like him. He gives a good interview. He's funny. He likes Jane Austen.
My perception from reading, I've read that this is now my second book when we discuss it. My first, he seems insanely smart. Like he's very,
I enjoy him. I'm nervous about the episode we're going to do on it because I worry I didn't understand the book.
I don't know
as far as I should have.
Yeah.
But he's a fun personality guy.
I did read some background on that book and I was like, there was some article about how the characters interact with each other. And I was like, oh, that's very, I did not notice that. And now that I'm almost done with the book, I'm like trying to read it with that through that lens.
That in mind. Anyway. Author as celebrity is a fun topic.
It is
fun. Oh, real quick. How much, what do you think? Is it all in Richard's head?
No.
No, it's real. It's not meant to just.
I didn't even think of that.
So he's actually on a scale 1 to 10, how much is he actually just a homeless guy who's lost his marbles and it's all in his head?
Isn't that kind of an easy cop out though for the story?
I don't think that's the point. It's not.
It could work, I guess, but the idea that the story is just all in their head, I think that doesn't give Neil Gaiman enough credit, really.
No. And I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying, how much had you consider that?
I haven't really, no.
Well, so, you know, the part kind of towards the middle-ish where Richard goes through his ordeal at the Blackfriars.
Yeah.
Right. And he's got to go get the key and he has to go through an ordeal. And you're reading it the first time, you're wondering, okay, what's he going to have to do? And it's really, he just steps onto a subway platform and people see him as a homeless person, you know, and people from his real life look at him in disgust and he can't explain to them, I'm helping this person named Dor try to find the angel Islington so we can get revenge for her killing her family. And it sounds insane. And the people from his life see him for it. It flirts with that. I don't think it's supposed to be an allegory, like that's what actually happened, but it is the ordeal with the Black Friar kind of raises that.
The reading's definitely there. You could definitely put that, but.
Well, and it's also, I kind of was thinking about how a lot of stories of this nature that have an ordeal, the ordeal is you being seen for who you really are, warts and all. There's actually a pretty cool part in The Magus by John Fowles. Okay. Where the main character kind of gets put on trial and just nitpicks psychologically really harshly. And that's his ordeal. It's in The Neverending Story a little bit. Okay. The scariest thing you could go through is for people to see you for who you really are. It's kind of in your mythopoetic journey. So that's here in this book. And I was just bringing up, people see him as, here's this homeless guy at the subway station. You know, you're sucked out of the fantasy narrative to, I'm just this homeless guy. But then we go back and finish the fantasy narrative. And I don't think it's meant to be a one-to-one allegory, but it's there.
It's there's multiple things going. There's multiple, obviously multiple, what, meanings or multiple, there's multiple aims of the book, I feel like, right? It's not I want to tell this, or, you know, yeah. I don't
know. Well, I remember reading once Tolkien, yeah. J.R. Tolkien.
Heard of him.
Upper right quadrant, good writer, but towards the canceled section I don't know what he did, but whatever. Yeah. He said that he hated allegory. And I remember when I first read that being really confused. It's like, I think your whole book's an allegory, right? But I think what he meant is allegory encourages people to look for the real world counterpart. Like he hated when people compared Sauron to Hitler. It's like, no, it's bigger than just that. This is an allegory, it makes people look for the one-to-one ratio or the real, what's the real world counterpart to this? And then what Tolkien and what other good fantasy writers with something of substance to say they're more, I guess you call it a mytho-poetic type rendering. They're getting at a truth. There's no facts or anything in their books, and there's not real world counterparts, but they are getting at something truthful through a fantastical story. Is kind of, that's what I think Tolkien meant, and I think that's how you should read Neverwhere and Gaiman in general.
What I would say with Tolkien, though, is where I think where they're talking about Sauron as Hitler is what is in the mind of the reader when they're reading the book.
Sure, sure, especially because of when it came out.
Not necessarily what Tolkien is meaning, but sort of the reader would probably make that connection. Tolkien might have no intention of that at all.
True, true. But that's why he said he hated allegory, because it makes people think that. And he's not going for that.
Yeah.
He's going for something much bigger than just a World War II allegory. Sometimes, you know what I mean? It's a timeless thing.
Sometimes your work is out of your hands. And
true, true. What, and you know, people are going to misread stuff. Yeah. But I do think that's not, you scratch the surface, you realize that's not what Tolkien was going
for. Yeah.
And similarly, I don't think Neverwhere, it's not meant to be a one-to-one. Here's an allegory of what it's like to be homeless. Although it deals with that realm. I think Gaiman was concerned. I think in an interview he said he kind of wanted to write something about people who get left behind in society.
Yeah.
And he did it this way. So I don't think it's on his head, but I think you got to throw that possibility in there into the mix. And I think he does it pretty well.
I agree. Neil Gaiman, he's back. I will definitely seek out his other works and read them. So American Gods is not my only Neil Gaiman now. I've read, funnily enough, Neil Gaiman reading was read during my wedding. People probably thought I was like
the biggest
Neil Gaiman fan ever. Neil Gaiman did this, it's sort of like a poem, but it's a wedding reading that I found. It's very good, and so I recommend.
Read it at your way. I remember.
So, if people weren't familiar, they're like, "God, this guy's a big Neil Gaiman fan." I'm like, "I've read American Gods only, and I did not like it, but here's a reading." That wraps up our Neil Gaiman and Neverwhere discussion. TBR, what do we got on the docket here? We've got Laris, a book that we read a couple months ago, but we still need to discuss. So we got that coming up. We have Midsummer Night's Dream, a little Shakespeare, first time ever on the podcast. Welcome him to the stage. I don't think we've done an episode on this, but we have kind of our running tradition to do the Flashman series in August, right? So we have Flash for Freedom, which is the third book in the George MacDonald Fraser series. I just started that a couple of days ago. It's really, he's the tone and the voice of the book.
It's just fun. Yeah.
It's just like, I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot. Oh,
he's back into it.
Yeah. We mentioned this too. Black Leopard, Red Wolf was a seasonal book many moons ago, and we're getting close to recording that upcoming. Over on our Patreon, we just did The Silent Patient, which was the first book in our Thriller Book Club. Very fun book, very fun episode to do. So if you're interested, become a patron over there. Not a lot of money, and you'll get exclusive episodes over there. And upcoming on there, we have Eight Men Out, which is a story of the scandal of Black Sox about 100 years ago. So that will be coming out. Kind of our baseball book for October, end of season. Let's see here. We have Life and Fate. It's a yearly book. Like I said, I think I mentioned on the podcast before. That's probably next year, if I'm being completely honest, when we get to that. Our newest seasonal is The Once and Future King, which I think will be a very fun read and discussion, too.
Have you started it?
I started it. The tone was different than I was expecting, and I like it in a very good way.
I'm halfway through. I got Sword in the Stone and Ill-Made Knight done.
Okay, so I need it. I will hopefully.
That's fine, but we're going to do, when you finish Sword in the Stone, let me know and we're going to do episodes on each of the four.
Each of the four.
Because they're different. I'm kind of noticing it's, we'll discuss.
Okay.
It.
Okay.
You know who does an introduction to an edition of Once a Future King?
Who's that?
Neil Gaiman. Very well read. It's one of the things that makes him enjoyable to me. He's read everything and kind of talk about why he likes them, why he loves them, why you should read them.
You're a bit sucking. The thing I didn't know how big of a fan you were of Neil Gaiman. So I'm glad we could get the. Sounds like one of your favorite authors, man. It's like a PR over here. No, I'm just kidding.
Sucker for a British guy in a leather jacket.
Aren't we all? So, very full TBR. We still have to pick. I think we're going to pick another book to read during August along with Flashman. So, we always have a good, healthy stack of books we're going through. So, feel free, as always, to reach out to us on all the social media platforms, discuss the books we're reading. Give us recommendations for books to read in the coming months. We always appreciate that. We try to select those books and add them. Hence, the Once and Future King was recommended to us, and we selected that book. So, Matt, any final thoughts? Any issues with the episode? Any issues with my takes, my feelings, my concerns?
No. I just think we try to ease you into the mythology and stuff. I want to read Wotan, but you definitely need to know about Norse mythology for that. I want you to read Magus, but I think there are certain things I want to read, but I don't think you're quite ready to hold back. So we won't read. You need to read. There's Neil Gaiman did a Norse mythology book. It's very fun. It's very engaging. You do the audio.
I'll say this.
And just.
I'll leave this episode with this thought for you and the listener.
All right, I'm going to write it down.
If we go down this path, I will make the effort to do some prep work, so to speak.
So that would be necessary before we even try, right?
Yes.
And it's going to be soon, but just you need a little prep work, and then we'll try. I need a
baseline of information about who these people are.
You're not just going to go run a marathon. You got to jog a mile, first. So let's.
I like that. That's my commitment to you and the listener.
Yes, sir.
No, I'm not. Oh, we will talk to you soon.